Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. This is not a United Nations conference, despite the look and feel of this table, but we thought we would try this shape. We're trying something else than the shape of the table for this workshop. We are going to try to... we've set ourselves a challenge of trying to see if in roughly 2 hours we can... reach some kind of results, pragmatic results. So the method that we have used, we have sent you a questionnaire. Thank you so much, all of you, for taking the time to answer all the questions we sent you. These questionnaires are available. We send them to you. I think Duda shared them with all of you. We're not going to go over the results of this. The data that it provides is for you to have a sort of a picture of where the distribution landscape stands by showing what each of you does and what each of you is planning to do. The next thing we've done is that in the open questions where you have kindly shared some of your ideas on how you see your near and far future, we have extracted from what you proposed tracks. By tracks, we mean actual proposals of what could be done, thinking that it was easier for you to react to them, to dismiss them, or to develop them. And this is what we're going to do during the time that we have together. And this is just a method. It's not saying this is what has to be done. It's what we feel came out of your proposals. So the purpose of this meeting is to try and help you and make it a collective moment of sharing ideas on what can be done in the immediate future to try and accelerate distribution and facilitate distribution. This is really the idea. We have invited guests as observers who are festival directors who are not distributors per se, but who are definitely connected with the idea that started the concept of this meeting, is to say... The job of a festival is to offer a launch platform, but what's the use of launching if there's no market to launch the content into? So that's the premise of this meeting. So we feel that festivals and related institutions or events do have a role to play within this. So what we would like to start with is maybe share with you a document that Liz... this is the program that you can see on the screen. The distribution wheel is a document that Liz is going to share with you. We have tried and we're going to run through. We're not going to discuss, and you can add, as we speak, the challenges. We've tried to identify the main challenges that distribution faces today and listing them. Then the 5 suggested tracks, as I said, once again, as a base to start our discussion. And then we will discuss this, and then we can continue the discussion informally in a drinks at the VPB cocktail area afterwards, which is always very nice. So shall we first take it to a round table?
Yes, but I also, before we start, I just wanted to say that this discussion is closed, and I know that it's difficult and that's why we didn't want to do a panel discussion, because it's much easier to be in where everybody trusts that they're not going to attribute or share what someone said. And it's much easier for us to be open and candid in a closed space. So everything that people talk about here, it stays in this room. And we wanted to point out also that we have a writer, Agnese Petribon, who is writing up a report that will summarize what we're talking about at the end. And we will ask you at the end, if you make comments, who wants to have their... First, to mention on the report whether you're here. You do not need to say that you're here when we actually put the report together, or if you are happy for your name to be there. We will ask you at the end.
And all of the information that you have already shared with us, as you have seen, is anonymous. It is not attributed to anyone, so it remains confidential in that way as well. Shall we... let's take a very quick roundtable, starting with you, Maud.
All right.
But we're going to go really quick, because we're just...
Hello, here. I'm Maud Clavier, Chief Operating Officer of Room Company doing social VR.
Hi, my name is Alina Mikhailova. I'm working as events lead on Engage XR platform and also run festivals at Blast Media Group.
Hello, my name is Eddie Lo. I'm running Sandbox Immersive Festival in China, but we also do distribution and production in Asia region.
Hello, I'm Jay Kim. I'm running a festival called BeFun in South Korea. Also producing some contents and distributing some contents in South Korea on immersive part.
Hi, I'm Jimmy from Semin Studios. I'm focusing on distribution, and I'll be joining Astria, Arthur's Five, and Jay's company very soon.
Hi, I'm Mia Bays, and I am director of the Filmmaking Fund at the British Film Institute. So we fund work, and then my colleagues run London Film Festival Expanded.
Hello, I'm Sasha Hartmann. I work in Arte France, commissioning for digital platforms.
Hello, my name is Babette. I'm a film distributor and also the project coordinator of a new project called New Reality to showcase on a daily basis VR in cinemas in the Netherlands. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Barkin. I'm co-founder and CEO of Lamina One, co-founded with Neil Stevenson, and we are building a blockchain and creator tooling program to help with alternative methods of financing and distribution of XR and creative projects.
And just to say, we have mics on each side, so if you want to keep that. Carry on, Joel.
Just keep going. Yeah. I'm Joel Newton from City Lights VR. We finance and distribute VR content.
Hi, I'm Fred Voluer, from co-founder of Atlas Five Group and CEO of the three companies, Atlas Five, Albion, and Astria.
Neil Carty, head of Cosm Studios. We finance, produce, and distribute Full Dome and fully immersive films, and we're building multiple venues to display that content.
Hi, I'm Paul from Diversion Cinema. We provide a solution equipment to showcase VR in good condition, and I'm also a distributor.
Hi, I'm Miriam from Montreal, from FI. So we have spaces in Montreal where we're presenting works, exhibitions, experiences, but we also have now a studio that is producing works. The first work that came out of the studio is a co-production with Felix and Paul called The Infinite. And I'm a curator.
Hi, my name is Guy Dallard, and I'm running the Luxembourg Film Board. And we also have a showcase on immersive works during the International Film Festival in March every year.
Hi, I'm Sam King. I'm head of program at Vive Arts, which is the art, technology, culture program under the helm of HTC. And we support artists and cultural institutions to experiment with immersive technology.
Hi, I'm Alexandra Payne. I'm the head of creative at OuterNet London, a new immersive entertainment district that focuses on arts, music, entertainment, culture, and most importantly, immersive experiences.
Hi, I'm Danielle Giroux. I'm with the Atlas Five Group at Astrea, representing a catalog of international immersive creators for publishing and location-based distribution.
Hi, I'm Amy Seidenworm. I have a new company called Antler, and I'll be also advising a brand new XR fund that's about to be announced soon. And I'm working with a bunch of cultural institutions as well who are looking to install XR experiences moving forward.
Hi, I'm Jeanne Marchalot. I'm working for France Télévisions. I'm the head of the immersive program unit, and we are co-producing VR experience and contents, such as Emperor, which is selected here. And we're also just bringing on stores our productions.
Hey, everyone. I'm Omar Subi. I work for Pico. I lead business development for EMEA, and we distribute content within the Pico headset.
Hi, I'm Olivier, and I run the VR game company called Ikima Show in Paris.
Hi, my name is Dude Holtkamp. I run the co-production market here, and I'm also a producer for a Brazilian studio focusing on games and experiences, and I'm very much focused on publishing on home devices.
Great. So I think let's start right away. Maybe Liz is going to share with us the wheel of distribution.
So I've been doing talks around different immersive formats for many years, and I keep track of the way these formats evolve with this wheel. And really what it is to represent is that there are many different forms of immersive entertainment. A lot of people talk about there's just VR, but there's also many ways that we engage with immersive entertainment. So it's trying to capture all the places where work is distributed and exhibited. So I have basically divided it into at home, which is in the top half of the wheel, and location-based entertainment. And this is sort of all, it's always really hard to map out these things, so it's quite general, but it's just to give you an idea that we are going to be covering, you know, this discussion is about all of this. The things that are strong at the moment or weak at the moment in these different areas. So we all know that on-demand storefronts, for example, it's very difficult because we're talking about creative, immersive content. But we're also going right through into talking about things that could happen in the future. So, for example, we're going to see more work in city public spaces, travel, for example, which is a new area. So just to give you an idea, we're talking about all of these different platforms.
We will make the presentation available if some of you want to keep it. The second thing please stop us at any time if there's a question that pops up that anything unclear. Don't hesitate. The second thing we wanted to share is a work done by Olivier Piazon here, who we have invited from Paris, from Ikimashou. Olivier, can you share with us what this is? This is a projection. We feel that one of the lacks that we have in the distribution market is a lack of data and projection tools that help us estimate what the business model could be for a content. But Olivier, I will let you explain in just a few minutes what this is.
I run a video game business, so I need to pitch to publishers, and one of the topmost questions that come up is, how close is it to something that the players know already? Because we need to market it in a way that is close to what they expect. You will get innovations in your game, but still, can it relate to something? So we constructed that out of an old algorithm that was that used to be called Steam Spy. It was an aggregate of all the information on the available freely on the Steam platform from products that were reviewed, and the number of review, the time they were on sale, whatever, and constructed back into a site that was aggregating that information to figure out how many units were sold and how much money was made for each product. We did the same for the Oculus Store, and that's our findings. The idea being that when we dive into a new project, we try to categorize it next to the ones that it seems to belong to, be it an archery game or whatever category you can come close. And then we evaluate if it's worth asking for several million dollars to make a game that is going to be with the other four that never made any money. That's what it is.
So the full 52 games. So the idea is we're sharing this with you because we feel that it might be an inspiration for similar models for a non-game content and help us think of tools that would help us project the estimated sales, for instance. So once again, this will be shared, but you can see that it ranges from incredibly successful content like Beat Saber to all other kinds of games. So this is here to serve as an inspiration. And once again, you're able to share or you? So this is just here, and if people are interested, they should contact you.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be much better. Actually, one thing, we constructed that, and then we went to the people we knew, and we asked them if we were close enough to the numbers, just to make sure that we weren't guessing, huge amounts or no. From the 15 person we asked, we are pretty close. We only know that we are underestimating the top 20. So they may have made more units. It's a little
What's really
more
useful than units. Is that you've actually, amongst a group of you, trust each other to share information. And that's
ballparks.
Yeah.
ballpark, but that's still, we don't have any information, and that's just as an inspiration for the kind of thing that we're going to talk about in when we come to the proposals and the goals.
And you're happy to share your contact so that anyone interested in digging further can contact you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great.
So Michelle and I are going to, we've aggregated the main challenges that you identified in the questionnaire, and we're going to very quickly run through them, just so we feel it's the basis of what we're going to talk about. So some of the main challenges of today are obviously that headsets are not ubiquitous in people's lives. We're all hoping Apple Vision Pro will reduce this in the future. There's a huge lack of curated access to non-game content, so the kind of content that we're showing in Venice. There's a lack of informed and equipped partners, especially location based in a small market, and a huge lack of data access and cases, use cases.
And this is why we wanted to share this model. Other main challenges we have identified through your responses is the lack of public support for scaling and distribution, most support going to production and development. Absence of distribution goals and strategy, and lack of clear audience targeting from the very beginning. By this, we mean that there's a lack of integration of distribution optimization from the very beginning of the development phase of a project. The distribution model that we see that is happening currently is directly, in fact, inspired by the film distribution model. And you and us question whether this is now the best model for both production as well as distribution.
We still don't have a Beat Saber equivalent as a killer app attracting users to new creative non-game immersive content. And there's a real problem with censorship of content that needs to be suitable for global family values on storefronts. Then one of the other issues is obviously that a lot of the work we're showing is not long enough for a lot of the platforms to take, because they're interested in replayability and long game content. And at the moment, the headset manufacturers who are financing content are solely focusing on financing big IP and games content, not the kind of content that we are showing at Venice and the festivals who are observing.
So what we have done, we have categorized five themes that have come through what you have given us as answers. So we're going to start our discussion focusing on the first theme with how can we optimize LBE distribution. So, yeah. So optimizing LBE. Here is the first track we see, is that right now LBE is definitely the better revenue generating market. That's what comes out of all your answers. Therefore, touring and installation costs need to be facilitated with ad hoc designs of the sets, transportability of the sets, so that it, right from the start, an installation is optimized in a way in terms of its transportability. One example of this is the way the FI Center has been basing, I guess, I mean, Myriam, you can tell us, basing your strategy from this. So we would like to first have your reactions on this. Is this something, the idea that optimizing transportability and touring logistics, does that sound as a strong recommendation?
I would just say, I think that one thing I've observed is there are some very interesting experiences that are emerging where there's more convergence between the physical sets and installation design, 3D installation design, and the virtual experience. And that becomes, in particularly the culture sector and the museum sector, much stronger proposition for venues to take, where they can provide something that feels more sort of cohesive in a whole. I think I worked a lot of my career in the museum and exhibition world, and I think that idea of object-based exhibition touring can be adapted and very neatly align and map onto immersive. And the way, you know, often that will work is to provide a design toolkit that accompanies the content of the exhibition, usually objects, but, you know, in our case, can be immersive experiences. So I do think on that point about transportability, I don't think that's necessary, because actually I think one of the things that's a real opportunity around exhibitions of this nature is the ability to bring down the cost to the climate and to not be turnkey and tour big sets, but instead provide a sense of design principles that can be locally built and then along with the content.
I was just going to say that I think, you know, for us at OuterNet, we're trying to create location-based experiences that, whilst I think obviously the physicality of having set design lends itself significantly to an immersion in those experiences, I think for us, we're trying to make them as low lift as possible so that we can run multiple pieces of content at one time, so that you can have different revenue streams coming in, so that you're being able to diversify where you're getting that revenue. So not having physical set design, but still being able to create immersive experiences that can be programmed throughout the day. For instance, we could put them on for 3 hours and then switch to another set of programming or to our commercial activity as well. Allows that flexibility, and therefore you're not locked into one experience for a significant period of time and therefore potentially losing out on other revenue streams. So trying to streamline those location-based experiences as much as possible, and whether that's through, obviously, you know, mixed reality or layering in other technology on top, AR and that kind of thing, is definitely something that I think we're trying to do more of, I suppose.
I'll say to you, sorry.
You can go ahead and add within.
A large part of what I led before I went to Lamina was location-based experiences at Magic Leap. And one of the things that we noticed was, like, when we were trying to build and deploy, for example, we were doing one for the Tokyo Olympics, and it was a 30-by-45-foot physical set and a multiplayer experience with, you know, multiple headsets. The trouble is like, when you're raising money to support it, if you don't build, like, 50% of the execution of location-based experiences is not just spending on the creative, it's the actual logistics. Like, we had to have, like, redundancy of three, like, the device redundancy had to be three in order to support cycling and charging. We had to get people onboarded and through a gesture-based tutorial and then through an experience so that we could hit 1,000 in throughput. And, like, that was the only way it made economic sense for the people who were funding it. And so I think, like, one thing I would say that I notice has been missing from a lot of the grants that we look at or some of the proposals is that aspect of it, is that half of the quality of the experience is, like, the user experience and, like, how well it's run and the cost of the devices and thinking through all of those things, because that is, like, the reality of what we're dealing with on the hardware side and on the funding side.
Just a quick note, I feel like most of the time in LBE, all the creators, they want to be free, so they build very different format experience, so it's hard for the place to have the right equipment to understand what's going on. And I know there is a French collective called French Immersive Studio. There are several studios trying to work on a common format. So if some creators are deciding together to try to do a more lightweighted format for LBEs, then it's easier for the locations as well to see, okay, if they have that equipment, I can have 10 content streamed, 20 content streamed, and not only one setup for one experience. So maybe that's also a creative work.
I'd like to add just one thing as well. So we're an LBE-based venue. Keeping it as light lift as possible is critical, especially when you have multiple content that's being played. It's not like a traditional 3-month run, but also taking into account storage space, right? So if you're building something, what can get broken down quickly? Do you look at mobile units? Or how do you build a canvas that is malleable for every artist that comes in? So, you know, we're making sure that we're building displays that we then brief and say, okay, here's an additional part of that canvas that you should be thinking about in lieu of a physical display, but make it lightweight in order to do so. I mean, we're thinking about that all the time. Every creator that comes in through our doors is like, I want to build some massive world-building component. I'm like, great, can it get broken down in 30 minutes? Then if it can't or it can, then that's what we focus on. I think that's a big component to the experience.
So anybody else on this point? Because we're going to move on to the next one in LBA. Great. So what we've seen has been experiences that are quite successful are some of the makers who are using non-specialized networks and venues. So we've seen examples of performance-based projects that are touring and performing arts networks and museums and galleries who are welcoming immersive projects. So not immersive, focused spaces. There are people like, for example, Gilles Jobin. He has really good case studies of when he did VRI and his other projects. And he's a dancer. That's what what he does. He's a choreographer, and he has a network already of venues that he used. He has designed his touring experience to fit into the economics of the touring model that he knows with all of his networks. So that's something that I think a lot of makers don't focus on. The other great example was Blanca Lee, another choreographer. It's super interesting to see that these are people who understand touring in performing arts spaces. A lot of the makers we come across do not think about that. They don't have the experience of the tour, the performing arts tour. So that's an example. Anybody got any comments on this?
Not necessarily on the performative dance space, but what I can say from music performance space, we look at scalability, right? So how can you create something that's turnkey, that can flip a switch and do it, at the same time bring in actors or a series of live actors or musicians where, for instance, we have a multi-channel display where, let's call it 10 musicians, right? Only three are available, yet it's built on those 10 channels. We actually have 55 channels, but that's aside and apart. But you can bring in elements to make it live. And not everything has to be fully live, but there's, you know, sort of a sliding scale that will give that element.
Great. Thank you. Can we move?
Yep. Does that...
Yes.
Yes, Sam.
Hi. I would just say that in terms of theatres, you know, this is also... For the theatre business model, particularly in the UK, we're going through a major crisis because of the lack of public subsidy, and the business models for theatres really needs revitalisation. So I think immersive is actually a huge opportunity for the theatres. But one of the challenges, I would say, in the culture sector is that the planning and cycles and the budgeting cycles do not map onto our timelines. They often work, you know, programming stages and programming galleries 3 to 4 years out. But one thing I think would be a very interesting strand to explore is opportunity to use spaces within theatres, particularly rehearsal spaces, that aren't detracting from the core revenue stream, which is basically the main stages. So I think Blanca Lee did that very well at the Barbican. I also think that's sort of interesting in terms of access for the public to these sort of hidden behind-the-scenes spaces in these historic institutions. So I think, you know, there's a big opportunity there, but I do think there's a lack of alignment also with the way that the internal processes work around budgeting and approval.
I just want to say that this point, we didn't see it, but it's very, very relevant. We have experience in Amsterdam with the Eye, which is the film center, where they have been using spaces that they don't usually make available to the public for arts installations. I mean, Casper is here, Avinash is here. I know that I had my own VR piece installed in the wardrobe, in the place, you know, where the coat check, and it worked very, very nicely. So I think that's a very, very strong point as a plus for venues. Miriam?
I think that we also have to convince people that are running the performing arts networks that it's worth to try to join forces with immersive creators and because for them, technology can be a bit of they are afraid. So this, like, we should invite them, you know, like, I'm sure there are some people that are running venues here, but it has to be maybe something that it's on top of the list to convince them that it's worth it to explore with us the presentation of our work.
It's a big part of our work at Diversion Cinema, because lots of non-specialized exhibition venues, they come to us because they need a VR installation. So we do lots of collaborations for a first-time venue exhibiting VR experiences. I think what is the most complicated for them, when we want to convince like a place that we have maybe a VR creative experience that could fit their programmation, it's to show them and to make them understand it can be interesting, because maybe they don't have so many opportunity to see and to discover VR experience. So we have seen like some festivals, some markets, I try to focus on museum, inviting lots of programmer curators to come. Sometimes it's bring new opportunities, but I think there is lots of work to do to share with them.
Thank you, Paul. Just a quick comment. And I think that for me, a lot of experimentation and actually the eye-opening experience for the VR distribution was when there was Venice expanded
satellite program, where during the pandemic, we all of a sudden got a chance to exhibit the same program that we see professionally here to the audience that is completely new. And they have never experienced anything in VR. And this is really eye-opening because you don't only need to think about all of those processes, like how to get people through the headsets, how to make it comfortable, how to onboard, but also what I love about Venice is if you come here, you see so many different types of content. And it's almost, we cannot talk about LBE distribution if we don't specify about which content. Because if we're talking about a 3-minute animation piece, that would be very hard to exhibit separately because people might enjoy it, but they would not go see enough value in a short form. At the same time, when during Venice, we were showing experiences like you have 1 hour, you're picking what to watch. That was extremely complex for new users because they were unprepared for some of that. And also, I feel bad for them because after some experience like Letters to Drancy, I saw it today, I need some time to process that. And then we're immediately putting them into something completely different. So it's like the preparation of the audience and what is our audience, how well they are aware of what they're going to see is one question. And then what type of content are we talking about in terms of length and depth and installation?
Hey, can I just add something quickly? I would want to share one concrete example. We started a collaboration with Atlas 5 on distributing ayahuasca in 2019. And on the top list of our goals, there was like maybe showing it at the Quai Branly Museum, which is a museum in Paris dedicated to anthropological and arts. And we managed, after 5 years, to convince them, to find people, to present them. It took like 5 years to meet them, to make them understand what we can do in kind of VR installations and to get like a collaboration with them because it's going to be exhibited there next year. So that's the time it took like to release for the first time ayahuasca and to get there. Maybe another example, maybe Babette, about like a non-specialized VR spaces that exhibit VR is a collaboration with New Reality in Amsterdam, or in Netherlands. Maybe it's time to talk about it, I don't know.
Do you want to take the microphone?
I think it's a great example of place that's not doing VR that start to doing it. But,
let's take. Should we share that one?
Short arms.
Yes. So hello. Starting with the fact that Michelle mentioned the distribution model from the movie world. As coming from the movie world, let's not adapt this distribution model from the movie world. But also being said about that is that it kind of works differently because in the film industry, we work with local distributors, which don't exist in an immersive community. We don't have local distributors. In the film industry, we have the rights of movies and we sell them to many, many countries as possible, which also finance the production of your film. So when I started 5 years ago at calling myself a distributor who had the urge to bring VR to a larger audience locally in the Netherlands, I was very naive because I realized it was very difficult to do. Nowadays, since a few months, I decided to not call myself a distributor anymore because when there are no locations to show VR, there is nothing to distribute to. So very practically, together with Camille and the team of Diversion, we started brainstorming around this, like what we actually need is locations. And I'm not talking about locations that are existing in the Netherlands, like Wonderful Eye, like museums or art galleries or wonderful festivals that showcase VR of interactive media in all its senses. But bring it on a daily basis to a cultural audience that visits, like, let's say, once a week. Well, that's a little bit ideal, but frequently visits a cultural location where they can very easily can choose if they want to see VR. Because I'm coming from the film industry, it was very logic to start with, we call them film theaters, but they're art house cinemas. And we very practical started a pilot project for 6 months in 3 of the largest cinemas to showcase 360 VR and interactive VR with the technology knowledge of Diversion and the curating and knowledge of Diversion. And with, I brought to the table marketing and publicity strategy. I think I'm already talking too long, but this was a very, we were very happy how it went. We will prolong this project with 5 cinemas more, and we did over 3,000 visitors.
That's great. I would follow this. It's definitely connected with the concept of scaling. Miriam, this morning at the presentation of the FI Center, you said something that you did not elaborate upon, which I would like to ask you about scaling the Carne y Arena of Iñárritu. You said that you redesigned this piece, which is known to be incredibly prestigious, but incredibly costly. And I think, tell me if I'm wrong, I think you said that you found a way when you restaged it to make it break even. Is that correct? Is that what you said?
So what we did is when the first iteration of Carne y Arena, when it was launched in Cannes in 2017, it was one person every 30 minutes. So let's say 2 person an hour. And then, of course, it didn't make sense, but it's such a powerful piece that when I remember coming back to Montreal and I told the team, we have to find a way to bring that piece to Montreal. That was my dream. And then they said, yes, but 2-piece person an hour doesn't make sense. So the team started to try to find a way to at least bring it up a little bit. So we brought it to 12 person an hour. It's still not much. But in Montreal, we presented Carne y Arena for 6 months and we did break even. So it's a long time, 6 months. It's a commitment for a venue. But we did break even with that. And we optimized the piece for touring. So we were not involved in the production at all, but we just optimized the piece for touring.
But that was both on optimizing the production cost, I mean, not the production, but the setting up costs and operating costs as much as bringing up the number of tickets sold per hour.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any other, I mean, there are examples like the Infinite, of course, where you have about 1,000 people a day. Eternel Notre Dame is also a model that breaks even and actually makes money. I think this concept of scaling is absolutely essential. I think, Sam, you alluded to it and you mentioned, I think everybody would agree, right, that this process of scaling, but there's almost like a science to scaling. Like, how do you scale?
Say, for example, a project like Eternel Notre Dame, the company Emissive, they have an operator. You know, they're working in a very commercial space who is licensing the project. So it's not the maker who is doing the distribution and setting up the exhibition, and it's a big professional operation. And they're bringing hundreds of people through. And that's a very specific format that they've chosen that is incredibly successful. So
Do you consider that in scaling the issue of positioning the ticket price is part of that, isn't it? How do you go about that?
Yes, I just want to comment a second on Emissive because Fabien is a good friend of mine, and you know we're all like just French people in VR kind of thing. And sorry about that, by the way. It's just crazy how, you know, the first project that became super famous for him and is, I think today, the most profitable exhibition in Europe is Cheops. And how people got to realize Cheops, it's not Notre Dame. Notre Dame is a commissioned work. There's Orange. It's a co-production. It's more like it's closer to the film thing. But Emissive success relies really on Cheops. And Cheops was shown at the Arabic Culture Museum in Paris, that if you guys haven't been, it's a beautiful museum. And we would expect that that was also kind of commissioned by someone. We would expect that the museum would be part of it, that there would be a discussion, Sam, you mentioned, with the museum about the programmation. Well, the reality is Fabien had to take his checkbook to pay for the place, for the PR, for the content, for the docents, for everything. So I think what we are lacking is just a reflection on economic model, who has to be involved, and who makes the check. Right now, Fabien is extremely courageous, he's extremely brave, it's bravery. You know, he puts his company and reputation on the line because he finances everything alone, and I would say the same with Miriam and Fight Center with the Infinite, and that's what we have to figure out. We have to find more partners so we can make that possible. It doesn't rely on the companies or the artists.
I'd also just quickly add, I mean, like, power of scaling comes into the diversification of formats. It constantly surprises me when I talk to someone that's working in VR that they're only thinking about VR. They should be thinking about selfishly full dome, venues, installations, and all that together. Not the experience is not going to be the same in every one of those mediums, but collectively you can scale. And there can be different levels of, like, that's where that one-to-one experience can work in some context because it's being subsidized by 500 people going through it elsewhere. And that may drive deeper engagement in the platform on headset in return and back and forth.
I just wanted to jump on what Fred was saying. Like, for us, we've found a niche in being that checkbook, right? Like, if you have an installation and you have foot traffic, but the museum's like, we can't afford this, and you've already spent your budget making a piece of content, that's what we're here for. Like, we want to underwrite more scaling. We want to do that. And I was here a year ago. We haven't spent any money in the last year because we just haven't found the right alchemy of foot traffic and good content. And we're still doing it with Spheres around the world. We're doing it with King Tut. We're doing it with different projects we made, but we would like to do it more. So I just wanted to say that.
We need a microphone over there for Eddie.
It's just interesting because it's true. I thanks to the festivals and the markets, I speak a lot directly with the artists that are ideating, and there is a big disconnect between the needs of the market and what is coming up. And I think there's a lot of earnest desire to make things that get out there, but I think that they need some support in knowing what works and some flex space outside of the festivals.
Hi, I'm Eddie. Just a quick note on the scaling point of view. So we've been actually doing a festival as well as distribution in China. As you all know, that China has a very big population, especially the density. So, for example, in the place where I live right now, Beijing has 36 million people. Shanghai is 28 million people. So the office that I work at right now sits in the central location of a shopping mall, and it has 13,000 people come into that shopping mall every day. So I think the scaling is very important. If we consider to distribute any work in China. I do agree with you on what just, Danielle just said. I think there is a disconnection between the supply and the demand. A lot of the festival pieces are not quite suitable for location-based distributions. It has a very high, it requires a very high understanding of the work, so it is a very high bar. So you have to curate a very special group in order to really appreciate the work that is showcased at festivals. But for example, the Eternal Notre Dame and also the Infinite is actually targeting a wider audience. I think that's super important. And actually, there are not many pieces are actually designed for location based. A lot of those work that is showcased at festival are not. It's very tricky. I mean, technology-wise, it's also very tricky. So I think some of the what has been really successful about the Kiops experience that Fred just mentioned is actually designed for a location base specifically, and it can put 500 people a day into that experience. And it was really it was even more successful. That the showcase was in Shanghai compared to it was in Paris, because it has 80% occupancy, which is, you know, you can almost impossible to get a ticket, especially at the weekends. So I think in order to scale, we have to have especially technology needs to be very, very stable in order to make it run through so many people at the same time, just like as stable as Disney attractions, right? But also at the same time, I think the content designed has to be specifically for location-based, and it will work much better than in the past, yeah.
Just from what I understand from what you're saying, that there's actually a difference between an installation and a piece designed for location-based. An installation is not necessarily synonymous with a suitable LBE.
Yeah, and especially, we showcase a lot of, installations at the festivals. Running those installations are such a hard work. It requires a lot from the docent, from the staff, which is, I think if we ask a group of staff going to serve other people at a commercial real estate, like a shopping center, to do a piece like some of the festival pieces here, just impossible, and people won't be able to manage that.
And we really noticed this year we didn't have any live performance pieces, and it really shows that people are getting a bit wiser to the fact that it's too difficult to bring them to festivals for 10 days. But we also have Eternal Notre Dame. Remember, there's a single player version, and it's getting makers to think in different formats for the same property as well, because they can exist as a single player or multi. Yeah, exactly. Moving on in the LBE space, we are going to mention this several times as we move through. There's a lack of data. So it's, can we produce really relevant data? Something in that was a great example of people sharing data within makers. But for example, when it comes to the performing arts networks I mentioned with Gilles Jobin and Blanca Lee, a lot of makers don't know about these networks, or we don't know about the available spaces on a national and global basis. So surely something like that, maybe that's an idea, is something that could be done quite easily as a research piece. So that's just an example. Are there any other examples of data sharing that we think would be useful for LBE?
Just very quickly, I supervise a group in France called CNXR. It's all associations that are bringed into a single federation. And we did a study for almost a year that will be launched in 10 days. And we asked all the people of all the company what are their sales they made in LBE, sales they made on stores, their business model, everything about numbers, and 40% of people answered, so it's like 500 company or so. So we will share those data, but I feel the associative sphere around VR, because there is a European XR association in all the countries, should do that study, national study, and be helped for that, because it will be very helpful for others.
Yes, I would like to add that on a very maybe practical level, what we did in during our project was a survey on the end for the staff of the cinemas and also for the audience. It was now a very small survey, but we plan to do that much larger, because the first finding, for instance, about the response of the audience, whom of 90% have never seen VR. So this is, I think, or interactive VR or whatever kind of immersive media. And I think that's really important to note. And this is information that we talked about to really share with makers, because I think it's interesting, for instance, that one of the very interesting things that people liked, for the audience liked the 360 pieces more than they liked the interactive pieces, which is, I think, a really relevant thing to realize. And of course, you should also mention what kind of audience it then is, because it's a different audience than people that go to a festival or have a large interest in VR. But if you want to have a business model, you want to upskill, you want to find more location, more audiences, I think it is information that we should share and be aware of who is our audience. It should be out of our community and to people who are broad, again, I said it, who have a broad interest in culture and storytelling.
I would say, so again, before Lamina, but I was at MSG Sphere. And this is like one of the things we haven't talked about too much. We talk about a lot about like VR and XR in terms of these installations. But that is one of the biggest, the largest scale sort of pieces of education that will go out there. It seats 17,000 people. And it's full on 4D, 16K, immersive, spatial, haptics, scent, humidity, all of these things. And like one of the biggest costs of being an early adopter in any of these spaces is the amount of education that you have to put into the market. Those marketing budgets are intense, and you have to educate people, and then you have the logistics. So I do think that there is something on the data side about looking at the correlation between these like mass scale immersive experiences that are not quite VR, but how they sort of lift all tides when it comes to like immersive and sensory content in general, because it's a matter of education, I think, for the market.
Absolutely. And I wanted to echo that, because I think that this is a very important community. We all meet, we talk, but I think it's also about integrating with those other networks. And so, for example, to your point, Liz, you know, we could be thinking about doing talks about immersive theatre at ISPA, you know, the International Society of Performing Arts Conference, where all the theatres that take touring shows are, or going to AAM, which is the American Association of Museums, or ICOM, where all of the museums go and they all decide to take on touring shows. They're object-based shows at the moment. There's no discourse there at the moment about this kind of work. So I think it's very important actually for us to go into those spaces as well, and perhaps also be armed with a bit of data, not just talking about our own projects, but talking about the sector as well.
Sort of further to that, I mean, I've been talking to a lot of cultural institutions and theater companies, and they don't have an innovation budget. So I think us being able to provide a little bit of information about strategy on, they have funding and they have funders who might give them quite a bit of money to dedicate a space to immersive theater and immersive work, but they don't know this language yet, and being able to provide them with some ideas on how to just earmark money for this will unlock a lot of those spaces for us. Doing it one by one is not going to solve it.
I can maybe quickly just back that up, because after running those like festivals for kind of non-prepared audience, but also talking to a lot of artists for whom, for example, in 2020, in at least my region, having seen Venice program was the first time they heard that there is art form in VR and not just games, tech demos and everything, because we also need to educate people what VR is, because I get questions very often like, what would you recommend to see in VR? I'm like, that's exactly like saying, can I see something on the internet? Like, what would you recommend? Like, what can I answer to you? What do you want to see? Because people are not introduced to that as an art form. So when we're talking about exhibiting those experiences, education is crucial. And for me, I started with educating the artists from my area to understand what are the opportunities. So it would be the second year this year running fully online and fully in VR, in social VR, educational course for the artists, where this year we will be concentrating on immersive performances and live theater specifically, because there are immense interest. There is immense interest in that, but there is absolutely zero information if you are not within this small community that is really hard to break through if you are not coming to festivals.
But I think we should like be encouraged by what we're seeing from the public and their desire to engage with immersive experiences, which at least in London, you know, is growing and growing exponentially. I mean, when we were supposed to open pre-pandemic, obviously like many of us were affected, but you know, prior to that, you know, we couldn't even tag immersive experiences on social media. That didn't exist as something, and we were trying to push that out there. And now one of the biggest drivers of footfall for us is TikTok, with people making stories going, you have to go and see this immersive experience, top 10 immersive experience to go and see in London. So I think generally there is like in the mainstream becoming more and more a desire, and I feel like we need to be communicating that better publicly and to institutions that this is going to be something that's going to drive your footfall and that this is something that audiences want to see, because fundamentally that's how they'll get their revenue essentially, which, you know, most of them care about.
Great, thank you. I'm going to move on to the next point, which is something that many of you came up with. So consider subsidizing distribution. As immersive content creation is already hard to finance, but we're really only focused, a lot of the public subsidy and soft funding is focused on the development and production. And distribution strategy and installation elements have been completely deprioritized, and mostly there are not funding streams in those organizations. So is there any way that we can unlock this? Are there any good examples of people who, public funding bodies here?
Maybe I can jump in, just because in the last 2 years, we've been very actively working with the French Institute. And I can say that all the festivals, they're small and they are in the places that you would not traditionally find VR, which is like, we've been to Tashkent, we've been to Almaty, we've been to Kazakhstan, like all of those places where there is very interested audience. They are eager to line up for 2 hours to see a 20-minute experience. I haven't seen that anywhere else. But it's only the French support for the distribution, and that they give us as festival organizers the ability to show the works without the license fee that they are including into the catalog, that allows us to run those events and maybe to add, depending on the topic of the exhibition, some other titles that we want from other countries, but the majority of the things that we've been showing is supported by the French Institute.
I mean, this lack is crucial because Liz and I have had the case of a piece that we have selected for the was for the best of section from the UK, and the team had to call us, you know, weeks after trying to get support to come. So we feel that it's really a shame that the piece couldn't come in the end.
And that's one layer you're talking about is festival support. We're talking about the whole.
Yeah. Can I ask a clarifying question?
This is
like for those who answered this about distribution. When you say distribution, what specifically do you mean? Because some of it is marketing that we're talking about, and some of it is actual venue. You know, finding venues. So it's helpful, like to me on the other side, to know what you guys are actually looking for.
I would say that by distribution we mean everything that happens after, once the production is finished, is completed, and it goes to an audience. And that would not necessarily include like premiering in a festival, but what happens afterwards. Like there's the production goes all the way to the launch pad that maybe a festival can be, and distribution is what happens after the launch has been made.
Sorry, I'm stealing the microphone from you. Sorry. Sorry, Michelle. I think we're talking about all layers, so distribution and exhibition. It's just this is a very new sector, and you know, when I showed in my wheel, there are all these different modes of distribution. So, for example, in the film industry that's been around a while, there's different funding streams for all those different parts of, you know, launching at a festival, international export, you know, for sales agents to find distributors, and then there's venue support in different types of fund, and there's marketing support. So it's all the different layers of what it means to reach an audience.
But the film industry also has Rentrack, so we know what the movie is actually making in every theater around the globe, and that's already some data to actually gauge if it's interesting to expand locally. And I'm not aware of something like that for museum, for specific LBE installations.
I think the word exhibition that you just said is kind of critical, because the costs of exhibition are not ever in the mentality of an artist or a filmmaker, because like, oh, some distributor will give it to theaters. Those theaters bought projectors a long time ago. But for almost every piece, it's like we have to provide the screen, the projector, the seats, we have to build a theater to show our movie. So those exhibition costs are never in the budget. They're never considered. I'm in Production Bridge, and most of my conversations are about that. Like, and we can provide that capital. We're happy to subsidize. We're not a government agency. We're investing in that capital to get a project to scale. But it's not considered at all in most of the creators' vision for their project.
Well, maybe it's helpful for you because, like, to your point, I think the point we were trying to get at is like there isn't an existing sort of economic model for valuing these projects and looking at what the right distribution is based on. Like, for example, with films, you pre-sell those because, you know, based on talent that might be assigned to it and things like that, and maybe that's part of an insight into how you evaluate, like, the footprint that you can get to and the economics you can generate is helpful to creators.
So it's again about data and breaking down use cases to have valuable information for investment.
Analogous to, like, you know, some of the things that analogous. Sorry, always mess up the word.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.
Just to answer that, I would say like revenue per square foot per minute. Right? If every creator could just think in the future, like this project going out in the world, how much revenue per square? So it's the per square foot on Carne Arena that made it so difficult, because it's one person in 1,500 square feet, you know. But revenue per square foot per minute.
But for that model, and then there are other models that need return. You know, there's an impact model as well that has a different return on investment.
Yeah, of course. But if the reason I say per minute is because we don't have 2-hour movies, like a 3-minute animation thing, I struggle to monetize things that short because people are hardwired to think of things that short as free. or the, you know, they're not like to pay $6 for a 3-minute experience feels ripped off. To pay $12 for a 6-minute, little ripped off. $24 for 18 minutes starts to make sense at a museum. You know what I mean? Like there's these sweet spots where you can get to over a dollar a minute or over $2 a minute is really great.
I want to, please, I want to come back to the idea of the critic that there's a lack of public support for distribution. What, first of all, to stress that we in Luxembourg, we're treating the immersive project in the same way than we're treating traditional films. They get the same support for distribution than the traditional movies. I think that you have also, when you do the budget for your production, watch out what the installation costs afterwards are and try to include them in the production budget. You were mentioning this morning Sex, Desire and Data, that is co-production between Five Studio and Aban in Luxembourg. So the budget included installation expenditures and expenses. So when they were part of our financing, so we did that at the beginning during production because
for the first run, right?
For the first run, yeah.
For the run in Montreal.
In Montreal now, yeah. Mm. But the other thing that I want to stress, for me, it's not only the lack of public support for distribution, it's the public support for production itself. Because look at, we have in the European Film Agency Directors Association, we have 37 members. I'm coming here now for 6 or 7 years. I've seen people from the UK. I've seen my colleagues from France. Every now and then somebody from the Netherlands. I'm talking about my colleagues, the film agency directors, and I haven't seen anybody else. Mm. So yesterday, for the first time, I met my colleague from Switzerland here, and I met my Belgian colleagues because we want to do a showcase next year together. So, but a part of that, there's nobody who's really interested in. They don't know what it is all about. You know, they don't know the... So how should they know the business model when they don't
even know that it
know
exists? Yes,
what you can experience here, what you can see.
But it's part. I think it's part of the nature of a slow ripple effect that this is still so new. We're seeing it, for instance, this year here at Venice Immersive. There's a whole new category of people who are coming for the first time and who are discovering it and saying, "How come we didn't know about this before?" Well, you know. You should have been informed. It takes time for something so new to start reaching people's interest and manifesting it by just getting involved. So I think the role that we can be done is try and accelerate this ripple effect by bearing in mind that it is by nature a slow ripple effect.
Yeah, but I fully agree with you, and I... You know, when you do not finance it, then you're not interested in exhibiting, in doing an exhibition of it as well. We have created in Luxembourg this festival during the International Traditional Film Festival together with FI to showcase the different...
And how do you think we should do that then, Guy?
We finance it through...
No, through your idea that the people who are making policy, because we're talking about people who are in high-level policy...
No, what I can offer is, we are one of the only countries in Europe that finance with the French and a little bit the UK, a little bit Belgium and so on. So there are only a few countries. So you have to raise awareness. You have to talk to the other directors about it, even though that would be if the other... country starting supporting it, that would be negative for us in Luxembourg, but whatever. I think we need more money to invest in the industry. So what I could suggest is we have this association, European Film Agency Directors. I could raise that as a topic once. We have a meeting in San Sebastian. So we could talk about it and maybe evolve on this, maybe doing a showcase, invite somebody from creators to show the directors.
We'll take this as a practical proposal that our future is
you
in your hands.
You asked us for proposals, so that's why I was...
Yes, we're in your hands.
No, but seriously, I thought of this last night when I saw my colleague from Switzerland who had never experienced VR before. You know, I'm talking to him and trying to explain that I realized that the problem is far deeper down than only so. Of course, distribution is a problem, but we have others to solve before.
Should be working.
Can I just add something? Of course, France Télévisions is a French public broadcaster, and we are the first French media TV in France, and we have a major port in Europe. Just now, our president, Delphine Ernotte, is the president of the UER, which is the Union Public Media Broadcasters in Europe. So, as you were saying, Guy, maybe what would be an idea is to present our immersive work, and what you do here to all the broadcasters in Europe. That would be maybe one point, because, I mean, I know how hard it is to make the immersive issues on the table on the broadcaster. I mean, France Télévisions is a very old house. It's like the BBC. So it's not easy, but I think it's possible.
And I think it's interesting to think about those key agencies that we need to target across the different sectors, because there are arts councils as well, and then there are other agencies. So any ideas for that would be really great. And
there's another conference called the Medici Conference, which I'm going to, which is just after San Sebastian, and that's international funds. So not... Some people go to IFAD and others go to that. And actually it's a really useful meeting point. And actually various film fund heads are talking about this. I can confirm, because I'm one of them and I'm in those conversations about how we collaborate. But I think, you know, also to Michelle's point, it's a slow burn, because, you know, we're coming out of a pandemic where all of these industries, like our funds have been propping up like economic crises. We still are. We've got strikes. I mean, we've got like a complete production block, people not working. So there's lots of, you know, I think it's been crisis after crisis after crisis, and it's not really stopped. So I guess it's kind of how we then approach this together. We, in terms of our immersive offer, we had a pilot, and one of our projects is the one that you referred to, that because we couldn't build distribution exhibition costs into the awards, because also the problem with public money is it's very complicated. You can't have hidden criteria. So if you publish, this is what we're paying for, you can't then just keep subsidizing, because it would just be endless. So it's also that we all have to probably co-design funds that are specific to immersive, that don't replicate the old film model, because that's the problem at the moment. It doesn't work. So we are in conversation, and I'm really happy to be here and active in these conversations.
Thank you, Mia. We're going to move on to the last... Oh, what happened to that? To the last point in LBE, and then move on to at home online. So a lot of the time, non-immersive or non-film festivals and venues still don't know how to deal with exhibiting immersive content. Would it be worthwhile to discover a way to be able to support education for exhibitors? So this is part of the education stream that Sam was talking about.
I think this is something that really came across in your responses. It's one thing to recognize that it's a good idea and it works to go away outside of the specialized events that already welcome immersive installations or content. But when you go outside of this, you find no one who understands how to do it, how to welcome you, how to set you up. And there's definitely this lack of understanding of what it takes to do immersive content exhibition. We've seen in the past in other venues how sometimes people think that it's just like what you said, you know, plug in, touch a button, and it's set, and it goes, and it's very easy. So I don't know if there are cases that you want to share or opinions you want to share about this, but this seems to be coming back quite a lot from your responses.
There was a very interesting case, although... So we've been distributing the work that got awarded, that got the awards last year. Is Xscape? Is it last year or the year before? Xscape, yeah. It's was very interesting because it's a for multi-person, right? And it also has a tablet, and you need to kind of use the tablet to monitor everybody's performance, if there's going to be scoring and everything. So when we actually prepared to distribute the work, we actually created like a little booklet to train the staff that's going to actually operate and run those shows. But it's extremely complicated. It's very, very complicated. And sometimes also there's the router doesn't work, and the headsets are stuck. So I think, as I said in the earlier point, I think there has to be a very stable solution technology-wise to make the LBE working. Otherwise, the entire thing would not work. And secondly, in terms of, I think also on the experience design, you always have to think about how, especially LBE experiences, you always have to think about the host, the docent going to work there, how they're going to run through the introduction section of that experience. If you design it badly, then it will generate so much operational cost at the location. And I think the staff are going to be very, very frustrated. Actually, the first time we got to train the staff to do the Xscape, and she resigned in the next day. Actually, so it's very complicated, and she would just do not want to bother to actually man the booth. So I think it's a lot of elements. I think not only on the operational side, I think the designer side also have to think about how to actually simplify the introductory levels in order to make it work at locations. And there's one side point, though. I think our as a producer, a curator, a producer especially, I think they also have to think about how to communicate across the message of how do you present the immersive experiences. It reminds me of Apple Vision Pro when they announced it, and they never mentioned any words about VR, right? So I think you have to also think about the consumer psyche. How do you attract someone who never heard of it and wanted to attract them and make them interested in give it a go, give it a try? So I think there are a lot of things that I think producers need to think about ahead of distribution, or even at the development phase. Otherwise, it will be so complicated.
And that was one of the challenges that we came across, is that and we were talking earlier about most of the producers don't think about reaching audiences at all, and it's not something we're focused on. So it needs to come into project development and planning.
One final note. So we provide a lot of feedback on how to operate on Xscape, and back to Herman. So now the team has been actively working on optimizing the initial level, so it will be easier for operator to manage. Yeah,
great. So we're gonna. Are you gonna go? Jimmy, you've got one last point. Go ahead.
So basically, we actually hear this back from our operator is, we have dedicated space for like Paper Birds, Measure Noir, Spheres, Xscape. However, the operator says there are two ways that affect the ticket sales. First is, of course, if the experience is actually good, because like Spheres is doing very well. Like we have 12 locations running in 6 cities in China. However, another reason that the ticket sales can really go up is the on-site staff, they will really choose what to really recommend to the audience, because a lot of audience, when they come here, they actually don't know what to try. They will actually ask the on-site staff and say, which one is the best one? Which one is the most popular one? And the operation staff, they will be like, yeah, do that one, because they can just put you on the headset. They don't need to say anything. They just wait until you finish. So if you need to raise hand, if you need to raise hand for so many times, they need to teach you to do this, they will be like, why I need to do so many work to do this. So Like right now, what we choose projects like from VPB, like we choose a couple of projects to discuss, is actually first to understand if the story or the experience is actually good for the audience that we can access in China or in South Korea. And the other hand is to actually look into the format that they're thinking. And then basically we will explain what kind of format or what kind of distribution we can do in China and actually to see if the producer can actually maybe change the mind or discuss with us to actually amend that into something that we can directly take over once the project is ready. So I think that actually can support, you know, on the distribution side when the project is ready, not even before going to festival, but it's already ready to go.
I do wonder, like, just as an action, if it might be helpful, because, like, for the Olympics one, I mean, we had a book that, like, down to a science was, like, how you move people through and how to think about economics, how to train, like, diagrams and everything. And we also had the team, like, all the list of the people that we had hire for what period of time. So that, because some of the teams that are running LBX are really skinny teams. Like, they don't have the budget to support that level. And I wonder if it would be helpful to have sort of a template or, like, a group of templates for LBX execution, because the UX is a massive part of it. So we hired experienced designers, you know, just to handle flow and timing and everything.
Thank you. I think we're going to move on to at home. So, you know, one of the huge issues and the things that you identified in the questionnaire was how do we, you know, optimize at home online entertainment. So at the moment, we need to really think about how we're going to get this kind of work onto platforms. So the distribution pipeline for games on Meta and other storefronts does not work for the creative immersive content. And we know that App Lab is an uphill battle for narrative projects and has a very slim chance of success. So this is the big one, really, I think, for our group, is like what are the ideas we have in this very, very impossible environment. And do we want to mention the festival collection here? I know it was going to come further down.
Yeah, we can. I mean, I guess what we have seen through your answers through this is the lack of easily identifiable, curated space within which the content can be, mostly for non-game narrative content. And how can we find a way in talking with the platforms to make sure that people who are interested in narrative content or documentary content, so that they know where to go, they have a place where to go on the platform. So how can we brand collections, you know, so that people can do that? And we, yeah?
Amy now, because you can, I don't know if Amy can talk, because she is no longer, and I know it's a very difficult thing to discuss, you know, with Meta.
What am I discussing?
I don't know.
How to get on the Quest store?
I think it's been such an issue now. We know that, you know, there's an issue of financing this kind of content and getting onto storefronts.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and I do think that there's an opportunity here for somebody to be creating aggregators for this, because App Lab, while it kind of exists in this weird universe where you need to find something, if someone were, I know you've talked about this with the festival collection, but you could create a trusted brand and link out to App Lab experiences and review things. I mean, you know, you get someone like Kent Bai, if he had a whole another parallel track where he had a public-facing forum where he was talking about experiences in App Lab after they're launched, people might be able to find them. And it's still, I think, somewhat preaching to the converted if you're relying on Kent Bai to tell people what to do. But Meta's not going to suddenly be excited about creative narrative work short term. They need to prove this concept on the gaming side and on the big IP side. And the fact that I'm not at Meta talks says a lot about that right now.
I mean, you were referring to the festival collection. Maybe not all of you are familiar with the
concept.
Oh, sorry. No. But with the concept, this is an idea that was discussed here a couple of years ago and that we've been trying to work on. The concept is that any piece that would be part of the official selection of an immersive festival would automatically be eligible to enter a brand on the platforms that would be called the Festival Collection, and it would be automatically curated by the five or six main festivals. The simple fact that a piece would have been in an official selection would qualify them to enter that collection. The Festival Collection brand on Meta would have different pieces than the one, let's say, on HTC Vive, because each platform would be able to choose what they would like, and the platforms would negotiate with the IP owners the contracts where it would go to. But that's one idea that we have been discussing with the different festivals and with the FI Center and with Guy in Luxembourg. We haven't finished that talk just because. From the Biennale side, it's very complicated for us to enter something like this. But the idea would be to avoid adding work for the platform or costs for the platform or for the IP owners, and just try and use the momentum of a selection in a major festival and aggregate all these different selections to materialize the quality of the content in the mind of the potential public, so that they would have a place or a brand, a label that would be recognizable on all platforms as a quality narrative, non-game content.
I remember last year you had a very interesting panel on how to engage journalists in covering immersive work. Obviously, Kent Bye is amazing, but beyond that, to the larger publications that reach a larger audience. And I think that is something that's still very vital work. And I'm thinking, public papers, Guardian, whatever, having kind of curator picks almost for being able to point to those platforms that can broaden out beyond the sort of immersive community. I mean, one thing I just want to share, I won't name the artist, but this is less narrative, but more sort of arts games, as it were, or artists who are exploring interactivity in their work. Was saying he's been doing some experimentation around publishing his titles on Steam and different platforms, and actually finding that there is, some success with that. And it's not necessarily the main strand of a project for him for distribution, but more a main thrust of it, but more a strand. And so actually he started to see sort of the top certain people following him on Steam and picking that up. And so I think that that is something that feels that's broadening out. Actually, there's an interest where people get a VR headset. They want a killer app title like Beat Saber, but then they want to see some more experimental content as well. So I guess the question is how we can best support that.
If I can add on to that, at Estrella, we've really been in the trenches when it comes to publishing these independent works on these platforms. And something that we've done, Antoine Cayrol is the founder of really the brain of and vision of Estrella, but there was this idea to create a proprietary code to integrate into the builds, so then at the end of the experience, it brings you to the next one and to the next one as well. So with Atlas, they've been really successful at working with Meta to have works that go on the official store, and then we've been adding works into the catalog that are really independent, and there are some funding support that actually we've been able to tap into with some public funds, for example, because what I mean by in the trenches is a lot of the builds are not to the standards that the store will need. There's a lot of work that goes into that, and thinking about what the design is in the menu and localization. So there's a lot of non-sexy work that goes into making them so that they can actually be ready for the store. And then obviously there's the whole marketing side of it, but it's true that there's definitely there is audience, there's interest. It's just slow and building. And I think that what we need some support with public funding, and showing the public funds the data of what can come from the results, and then marketing, finding ways to embrace the weird of VR and probably taking more inspiration from the VR chat worlds and trying to connect with those communities. There are some major steps we can do.
Can I just add something? I totally agree with what you said, Danielle. There's a huge work
within when you have an immersive content to put on stores. And of course, the idea of having a festival label, I agree, it does fit with independent creators. But how can we do that with when the project is well-financed, where there's a co-production, where there's a broadcaster like France Télévision? I mean, our aim at France Télévision is to have a catalogue that we publish on stores and to have a brand France Télévision content to be visible and to put our label for, you know, new kind of storytellings for the what will be TV next. I mean, in the, you know, what's the future of TV? So and that's what we're looking for as well.
How easy would it be? I mean, I'm going back to what you were just saying. How easy would it be to make these experiences more accessible in the network of distributors, or do you consider this is so precious and proprietary experiences you can't share it with anyone, you know, because it's part of what you explore?
For the published works that we have?
Or,
well, we're working. We published quite a few works in the last few months, and we can share the App Lab links. It's public. It's totally public, and we're continuing to get those works that we added to the catalog. So, End of Night is a big example because the build was so heavy. That was the one that we worked with Macropole to go back to the DFI to ask for extra funding, and it's available on App Lab.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Can I maybe comment quickly that we're kind of talking here about two different distributions, right? So we already talked about distributing the end audiences that have absolutely zero understanding what is VR and their challenges. But then now with the home distribution, we're kind of trying to tackle those people who are already possibly using VR. And that's another big challenge because we all know that if you don't have the reason to return to the headset, it will stay on your shelf and you're not going to return here. So for me, working in social VR, the answer is the only killer app for me right now to get into VR is that some people are expecting for me to be there. So it's social aspect. But at the same time, if I'm not following specifically the creators or the studios on Instagram or on Twitter, it's extremely hard to know that End of Night, which I loved, is actually public. So I'm thinking that kind of once again, it's this phenomena that almost social VR platforms, like people inside VR chat who are super VR savvy and they're looking maybe just for some experiences, they're absolutely not reached to cross the line and come to the standalone experiences. So maybe if we consider that actually the must for the distribution and for the marketing of the distribution is to come to social VR platforms and to possibly either run events or do some announcements or do accompany the piece of that to target the audience that is already coming to VR. And that's what we're not seeing right now in social VR.
And that's the strategy at Venice. Obviously, we are connecting these communities. And it was the first time VR Chat came here to see what we did. And they were so impressed. And we hope that is going to grow the relationship. But can I just go back? We're going to move into that point in a second.
Oh, I was just circling back saying that nowadays we have a lot of influencers on Discord and so on. So we have several Ken Bais, like that, let's say. And those people are bringing newbies into VR. And I think they are kind of new TV channels by themselves. Like we know the TikTok creators, YouTube creators, and all those creators that are getting into VR saying, okay, those experience exists. And then you reach to them and they reach to other people. So marketing distribution thing.
Great. Can I just say something that I found, and you were talking about App Lab, and I think Michelle was going, oh, what can you share? One of the things that I found really disappointing when we were looking at our best of was I found nothing on App Lab. I scoured and scoured, and I know that it's really difficult to find things already on it, which is an issue. I had to read through every blogger, but I found End of Night. And then obviously there was Fight Back that Jean mentioned to me the other day, reminded me the other day. But there was little that we had in the last festivals. End of Night was 2 years ago. So that's a thing, like, you know, the influencers thinking about these big communities already, and other ideas are really important for how we are going to get people to this kind of content.
Definitely investment in marketing. Fred is going to talk, I think.
Thank you.
There's a reason that, you know, there's a reason that's like that. And to me, it's super simple. You have a headset and a marketplace. It's run towards, it's geared to sell games, right? So, because games have liquidity. And that has been like that for a while, and it's great. It's great for everybody because games are platform sellers, are headset sellers. And and we're all happy that Beat Saber exists. Parallel world, you're here, and like Shari is here, the creators, you're here. You looked at what we do, you looked at us, and you said, this is interesting. This is a new art form. This is something that should exist. And actually, you know, thank you for that, because you created an alien, you created an industry, you created us doing so. But now we have the problem of showing it. And, you know, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it's not going to work. So that's basically what we do when we ask entertainment, artists, crazy people that we love to go on App Lab and to be good on like the kind of figures we've seen before. So back to what Amy was saying, I think what it takes is actually, again, like courage, bravery, to create some kind of aggregator where the promise is, you know, you want your brain to explode, you want to be taken to a new world, you want to discover a format of entertainment that you did not expect to find. We are going to curate that for you. That's what it will take.
I think this is what Guy and Myriam, I think we need to pick up the conversation on making the festival collection a reality in a way that is viable. And I think, Fred, that goes along the lines of what you are saying. I mean, this is one proposition, the festival collection concept. I think we will move on to the next point, the final point on the home thing. Federating distributors to lobby the platform for clearly identified curated brand for creative narrative. I think that's exactly what we just discussed. And most producers have little experience with home distribution. Should we consider working on some form of education by, for example, sharing case studies on marketing and distribution? I think this is what was alluded to, and I think there's sort of a consensus that this is a direction to explore. Am I right? Anyone wants to add something on this? But I think you alluded to this. Once again, this comes from your responses. I just want to add that the exercise that we're doing right now is really trying to formulate things. So everything we're putting on the screen is actually coming from you, and we are running it by you so that you can compliment, criticize, or confirm. So it's all about trying to come out of this with those wordings in a way of where we stand.
I just would like to ask a question. Because I imagine if there is an app called Venice, let's say, with many authorish content and that are published on Meta, the person who's running that intermediate platform will need to monetize as well. So does it mean that Meta takes a percentage on the app and then the app runs? I mean, I'm questioning the monetization of that, because for now you're taking a percentage of every app that is there and it's like 30% of the thing. But if there is someone in between doing curation, would there be extra monetized step?
The idea of the festival collection is that a festival collection doesn't own anything apart from the brand. And so it's like a stamp of approval. And I think that was one of the things Amy was talking about. It's like having a brand that's identified with a certain type of quality or creativity.
Okay, so it's not an in-between app, yeah. That would be... Okay.
But then we're something like the Biennale, we cannot be take money. We cannot be involved in transactional things.
No, but I was giving the example even for other people, because there could be a Biennale brand, like, okay, it's stamped by Biennale and there is still the app on the App Lab, but there could be also intermedium, like TV channel, say France Television creates an app and has some content on it.
Yes, the two could coexist, absolutely.
One other thing I just wanted to say, and it's sort of a lot of people have touched on this, is that we need to also encourage creators to have larger budgets. I think they're all so desperate to get any kind of funding that they're not thinking about this next step. They're not valuing their work beyond just getting that first seed budget going. And as a producer, like when I was at Meta, we would just say, yes, add 25% to whatever that is so that you can actually market your work, so you can get comms and all that. And I think that's going to become even more important when you need to sign on to marketing, whether it's, you know, the festival collection or something else, figuring out a way to make your work stand out.
And I think this has come across in the LBE discussion, and this is the ambition, is that we have to be ambitious to grow.
I do think there's like a philosophical question, though, that that comes up a lot, which is like, we want the money and we want the funding and we want the distribution. And so we go to the Meadows and they fund it. And but they ask in return for exclusivity and a pretty significant revenue, right? The piece of your revenue. There is an alternative. It's coming with Web3 and with blockchain, but you have to look towards open models, because standards are a problem. App stores are closed ecosystems. You're talking about walled gardens, and it's real hard to get past that because the economics already work.
And we wanted this to be one of our talking points. I don't know if we're going to get to it because we've got to move fast, and so we can come back to it. But we'll move through the last ones really quickly.
Liz, if I could just add one really quick comment. Really quick. Like, one, I feel really good that I'm not the only person out there saying add 20% to your budget, because I'm ready to get fired every single day. But also, I think it's the obligation of the commercial providers to provide those resources. So we put our full stable of agencies against marketing and promotion. We give them PR, all the stuff that typically a creator wouldn't be able to afford. I think that's important, as on the LBE side, that we all do that.
Great. So we're going to move on to our next point, which came up, and that was to explore social platforms and world builder communities. I think Maud and Alina are always already alluding to this. So platforms like VRChat or Engage do not have any way to monetize some of their user-made content at the moment. And if and when they do monetize, it would open up all kinds of possibilities for generating revenue. So exploring producing projects as worlds is a preparation for new business models as much as new creative models.
I think on this, for those of you who were here yesterday on the panel with Finns and Mike from and Alina from about the world builders economy, it was very interesting to hear both Alina and Mike saying that this is in the pipeline. One way or another, it's coming. We think that it's a very, very, very positive evolution, when there would be a ticketing system, when there may be a proprietary currency to the platforms that can be connected to the world banking system, so that you can transform whatever income you generate in the platforms into actual money. I think this is going to be a very strong new way. You disagree?
No. Because we've been talking about the VR.
Excuse me?
No, because it's a phenomenal opportunity to enable creators to have royalties from things that they're creating, and it's these incredible worlds. But when we spoke with the VRChat teams, like, they're very, very hesitant to include any monetization. And that we were trying to understand that philosophy here, because it is a great way for blockchain. Like, Lam and I, would be a perfect target, like, for us to say, here's the infrastructure, and your creators can fund themselves by providing elements that, like, people are using, and they're building mini games. But I was curious why they weren't open to it. They said that they had a bad experience.
Did you come to the panel yesterday?
No, I wasn't there. Did they talk about it?
Because They. What's very interesting is that obviously a platform like VRChat, maybe it's less okay, but we should listen to Alina. Just a word about VRChat. What Mike was saying is that they are approaching this in an extremely cautious way. They're being very, very much aware of the fact that the whole ethos of VRChat is free, based on passion. People do it as a passion hobby. But what they're doing is that they're step by step, they're consulting their users all the time on everything. And it's going to take a long time before it's actually implemented. Yeah. But they're very, very much aware of this. And I think what you perceive as being hesitant is actually being ultra cautious. But they did confirm that they are embarked on that process.
Because the platform is the community, if you've got to move really slowly with the community,
I'll let Alina. Yeah.
So maybe I can share a little bit about what are the challenges and what are the risks that those who are not working in social VR might not be aware. And I'm not speaking here from Engage because I kind of run events and jump all over social VR platforms. But the challenge is that, and that was the story with Altspace, where one of the very big creators of the events, they started to charge outside of the platform. And they were, as far as we know, and the rumors, but we're speaking openly here, that the app was basically threatened to be taken off the store because technically, you have to, like, if your app is on MetaStore or on Steam, you have to pay 30%, right? So if you're monetizing events outside of the stream, you're basically breaking the rule of the platform. But at the same time, if I'm running an event on Engage, for example, which has completely different business model, which is licensing, but at the same time, people are paying for that. If Meta and Steam and everyone else, and we're on all the platforms, are coming and saying, hey, where's my 30%? That's not even going to make any type of calculations. So that's why it's not even the question of monetization, but it's actually a gray area legally. And I don't think that there is a conversation, or at least I cannot comment on that, going with the platform. So obviously from Engage, I know that it's on the roadmap, because one of the focuses is events, and it's not even for the platform, but for the businesses that license Engage to run their events, it's essential to be able to monetize that. That's a lot of the kind of strategy is coming from. But for right now, for Engage, for VRChat, and those creators that, for example, risk to run events like immersive theater shows on VRChat, we're all operating in legal gray zone where we don't know what would be the results if platforms decide to go against us.
I do think so. We're kind of at this like moment in time, and I totally am aware of that problem in the conversation around open standards and like trying to get to an open metaverse with this world where you can kind of move fluidly through these interconnected worlds of like digital experiences. We're not there yet, but like when Apple starts to talk about okay apps that do allow for those creator marketplaces where you could use a proprietary currency that has value in that system and can help the people, the creators actually raise more money to do more creative. Like Apple's talking about also then taking 30% of the gas fees that are required for the validator community on the blockchain side to allow those transactions to take place. And you start like this closed ecosystem that is controlled by the tech giants that right now we rely on for financing is really starting to eat it at any kind of ability to be profitable. And so I do think there's a need to like break it a little bit and challenge it because it's not okay.
Can I also just clarify, because I think when they were talking yesterday on the panel, they discussed the tentative steps of moving into the kind of building their own sort of currency, which I think I sort of see the implication there, but then also it sort of goes against the opportunity, as Rebecca's saying, about interoperability with other platforms. It's more akin to like Linden Lab, Linden Dollar, Second Life, than creating an economy that can go beyond that.
I have it a feeling.
It could be, but there are some blockchains, like Lamina is built fundamentally to enable interoperability between a bunch of other currencies, and you can brand that currency. So however you want. You're just not running, because creators shouldn't be worried about running the consensus layer. Like, you don't want anything to do with that. But you have to be architected in a way to enable interoperability, and then also, which the blockchain community hasn't done today, is protect performance, which creators care a lot about. And right now, on public blockchains, you don't have the protection of security and performance at the same time, right? So your gas fees are through the roof. It's like Sandbox has struggled with this with Polygon. So there are solutions that are designed for creators to be able to protect those things and enable interoperability, because a lot of that comes back to identity, which is a whole different thing we won't go into. But for cocktails, maybe.
Sorry, I just wanted to share briefly my story like that to have another take on the issue. So we've been world builders for 3 years with Vroom on many platforms like VRChat, Engage, Roblox, and we could not monetize our concert, and we were getting more and more specialized into working with festivals and concerts. Mm-hmm. And we were also bringing R&D to those platforms. So we decided to create our own, and it's going to get launched in November. We thought a lot about the monetization issues because of those platform rules, because of everything. But we found a solution so far that we're going to use. It's a bit like Rec Room. So we are going to have people able to spend their money in the platform with the in-app purchase to buy room coins that are not a blockchain-based money, but room coins. And once they buy those room coins, they can buy tickets to go to concert and merchandising. But there will be a huge step educating people about paying for that. Because so far, there will be people coming from VRChat, coming from Engage, coming from other platforms, and used to be to have everything for free. But we're taking the risk to have a curated content from A, to work with artists and people who are talented, and to have live entertainment. I mean, we decide to have a straight line of type of content. Like that, we have a crowd that is coming for that, and that is used to pay for creative content. And then we will, of course, at the beginning we'll do free events, but step by step we want to educate people as well to pay for this content. So it's a road we're taking, and coming back on the global discussion, I think distributors have a risk to take as well, because we're talking a lot about how creators can distribute their work, but we're not talking about how distributors can become really distributors and either build some places, either build some business, either take some risk. So we are taking the risk to build a platform that is European, that is trying to have European values to be monetized here. It is complex, but we believe it's worth taking the risk and having a new ways for creators to line up. And the last topic, sorry for being long, but I think the content creators should be also aware of the different distribution channel and optimize their content. If they do a piece for LBE, so often they do the Quest version of what they do for LBE, and then they could do the social VR part of it. So either it's an event to do a marketing thing, or either it's a new way to create for social VR. So that like that, they have all the distribution channel. We did that for a few pieces, and it's very different, the storytelling from one to another, but you can optimize a bit your production and the 3D assets and all of that.
Great. We just want to say a word about something that you have already said, which is one of our fourth point, is to build networks and aggregate. There has been examples of this with the Galaxy network. I don't know, Paul, from Diversion, if you want to say something, but this came out of the Venice VR expanded at the time during COVID, when about 15 venues connected together. But what seems to come out from your responses is the feel, and it was said before, this is why we're going quickly over this, when you said you need venues, you need locations, all of you were saying this, Babette, you were saying locations, and it's really about this. And do you agree that the idea of federating venues is essential to the spread and the growth of an audience? So this is what this point is about. But maybe, Paul, you can say a quick word about the Galaxy Network.
Yes, we have been coordinating two editions of the Galaxy Network. So the Galaxy Network is like a reunion of different venues that has been exhibiting VR during like COVID with Venice. So they were satellites of the Venice Immersive. And we did two editions, with each edition around like 7 partners exhibition venues. It was great. What we do as a coordinator that simplify a little bit the life of this venue is that we propose a curated package, a curated program of VR experiences around like a general thematic. There were around like 10 or 8 VR experiences in each edition. And also we simplify all the juridical process, so clearing all the rights. They do to us one single payment, and then we have a contract with all the creator of the producers. So we simplify all this process, and also we deliver, so digitally, all the materials they need to set up the exhibition. So it's, the build or the VR files, everything, but also a marketing. So we deliver like a toolbox, in fact, where inside there is posters, images, all the synopsis, all the materials they need to communicate. And of course, they are free to adapt. So it's a PSD file where they can put logo of their partner. So that's something we do. That was a great experience. The result is that it's lots of work to coordinate something like that, so we need some support as a coordinator. But also, each venue, each location, you know, in the network, they have very different business models. Some of them, they are like self-finance, other ones, they are public institution. So their expectation can be very different, and so that's where there is like a question mark right now, is that how do we continue with this network, but with very different kind of exhibition venue with a different expectation. So, yeah.
Miriam, did you want to say something about this as a leading venue? How do you see yourself, or how useful do you see for what you do this idea of structuring a network of venues?
I think this is essential. I've been dreaming of a network of venues for years. We've been discussing together for a long time and with other people, but it's also who's going to take the lead. You know, that's the only thing everybody thinks it's a great idea, but there's 24 hours in the day, and so maybe there is a pilot project to be made with, I don't know exactly which institution, but it is essential if we want to be here in a few years.
And is there some research that has to be done first of what venues are there and some of the data points that we're talking about that comes before any of that? And I guess other ideas of the fact that we are an international group, of how we stay together, is there something we can do in terms of sharing data beyond this conversation as well, that we can operate as kind of network?
And I think we're going to wrap on this. The fifth point is very much connected to what you started discussing about, you know, Web3, blockchain, and Alina.
I just wanted maybe to quickly mention on Galaxy Network, because that was an extremely interesting experience. I was running together with Diversion and everyone. We had, I think, 15 satellite venues, and then we started doing Galaxy, which I also did once. But it's very important that it's about education for the locations as well. It was incredible to have those locations that decided to experiment, and when we were sharing and debriefing after that, because the whole purpose of Galaxy was to make it easier for those locations that do not do that regularly to distribute, to coordinate and save, because we all know how hard it is to break even on those exhibitions, to coordinate and save any budget that we can on mutual marketing, et cetera. But it's also very important to, and I think that the example of Phi Center is so inspiring, at least for me, because you also have to educate the audience where to find this content, because I don't have the venue and I've been running those events in different venues. The most common question that I get from people that have seen it, and they're so inspired, and they're asking, where can I see more? And I have absolutely zero answer for them, because there is no consistency. So if we can grow like a 5-year plan of the networks and places that can be supported, so people get used to that, there would be an audience forming for art narrative content to be distributed.
I
want to add one thing.
Just very quickly.
Very quickly. So Europa Cinemas is one of the financial supporters of our pilot in the 3 cinemas, and they're very enthusiastic about what is happening. Of course, during Venice, many, many of the directors and managers of cinemas are here watching movies. So one practical solution is to organize, you know, special day or half a day to invite people to come over to watch VR, because we noticed in the Netherlands they're really, really interested in showing VR in the cinemas. And also I wanted to add that the cinema rooms are there, the installation is there, so it's not that difficult of a location to showcase VR in this
It's more instances. A question of motivation than actual space, physical space.
Yes.
I just wanted to say one last note, because you not all of you may be aware of this. When we did the satellite networks connected with Venice VR expanded in 21 and 22, we had complaints from the producers of some of the works that you were showing, saying, well, where's the money? Because you are showing our piece now in 15 different venues. Those venues could potentially be buyers of our piece. They could, because now we cannot sell it. We cannot sell it to Five. We cannot sell it to the venues that took it. And we had some really tough discussions with the IP owners, saying, well, the venues are trying to break even. We understand it's very costly, but it's our IP and it's actually destroying the potential for our distribution. So there was a real negative response, and we had to explain this is only for the 2 years of the COVID, and there was a lot of requests to continue this idea of expanding, you know, the Venice immersive into the satellite network, and we stopped it and we cancelled it for that reason, because the IP owners didn't find that it was fair to them.
The problem that it's not happening otherwise, because those locations are not going to license a 5-6 minute piece.
But that's what we said.
Exactly.
That's what we said.
And it's just because when we tried to run the Galaxy Network then, what was very smart, and Diversion did amazing job supporting that, we actually were trying to put tickets into separate tracks, at least that people can understand. Like, they're buying ticket for the storytelling track or for the meditative track. So they can understand what to prepare, and then we would combine experiences that can justify the cost of the ticket, but at the same time they're matching what they can see, like three experiences in a row, but very much adding to each other's in terms of how we create this experience.
But just I just wanted to mention this, that it from the producers and distributors' point of view, it was a big question. I think we're going to, yes, you wanted to? Yeah, we're going to wrap. Once again, thank you for the exercise. The dynamic of this exercise was really your responses and our work to try and extract and run it by you. What we're going to do now is that Agnese here is going to write a synthesis of what we have extracted, your reactions to this. We're going to circulate it to you, and we would very much like to ask from each of you to just tell us very quickly, when you will receive it, your estimation of this format. Did this work? Did this help? Did this add anything, or was it just another panel among hundreds that we all go to? We would love to hear back from you, because our concern, Liz and I, is to try and not waste time, but try and get added value from the time we spend in anything we do, you know, on the island. So it's extremely important. And don't be shy and tell us if you think it's rubbish. We will not be upset. It's totally fine.
And the other thing is, at 6:30 tonight, we thought, you know, you've got a couple of hours to sort of mull over this. I know you've got things to do now as well. Is we will, if you would like to join us, it would be great, in the VPB cocktail area that's just to the left of the exit here into the garden. We can have some drinks after the Meet the Creator session. And what we could do is, if any other thoughts, if we don't get a chance, you know, to speak to Michelle or me, it'd be great. You know, maybe it's a good idea to talk to Agnese, who can jot them down and add them to the report. But please join us at 6:30.
And I would like to thank our observers. Thank you for being respectful of your position. I hope you understand the reason for this system, if you're upset. But it's also a chance for you to react on what you heard, and so we can meet at 6:30 for drinks there. Thank you so much for playing the game with us, and let's move forward.